Hello.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember us?
It's Melissa.
Oh, and me, Sarah. Talk Murdy to us. Talk Murdy with me. What's our podcast
called? Talk Murdy to me. Talk Murdy with me, baby.
I really forgot for a second.
Oh, it's been a couple of moons since we've been here. Oh, no, it's been less than one moon.
Yeah, because one moon is 1 month, right?
One full wax and wane. We currently have a waxing moon. I've been checking my lunar calendar.
For what?
I like to know when it's going to be a full moon.
I don't. I like it to just sneak up on me.
You just like to see everything go to shit in the world in your daily life and go, it must be a full moon.
I'm a teacher.
Yeah.
The full moon days are the worst.
I know.
We had a full moon Friday the 13th one time this year.
Yeah.
And I don't want to know that going in.
won't show up.
Yeah. I think I might be sick that day. No.
Oh, man. Guys, it's been, what, 2 full weeks since we've come on the air?
It's been a long time since you did. There's a TikTok that's like that. Obviously, nothing's changed.
I know what you're talking about, yeah. But I don't know.
Do you know what song it is? It's probably by Doja Cat.
Fell in love.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad you knew the words.
I liked your instead. Yeah, TikTok still runs our lives pretty much the entire time Andrew and I were in Michigan. Anytime anything happened, the two of us would just be over there going, this is perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect.
The thing is that you guys are so far behind on the trends.
Oh, no. It wasn't like because we thought it was current. We just said it at one point, thought it was hilarious, and just kept saying it.
It's like when you guys...
As senior citizens do.
Like the Picasso thing you guys were into that one night that I wanted to murder myself to.
We also at some point started screaming, can I pet that dog? And Leanna had not seen it. We had to show it to her. But she sent us another video of it this week and said, this is still in my head every day. Thank you so much. So we're just spreading joy.
Thanks for rubbing all your friendship in my face while I was here at home. Being friends with my good painter, Russ.
You guys did become pretty fast friends.
Well, we had already been friends last summer when I painted the other part of my house.
That's why it felt faster this year.
He didn't drink enough of his Powerades.
At least he wasn't the same people who installed the flooring who just drink your beers instead.
Remind me not to make that joke again. So.
Well, guys, happy summer. I feel like it's fully summer now.
Yeah.
Because you're off school.
Unless I've been off school for a long time.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, because you're off school.
Yeah.
And we've taken a trip together.
You do know I go back to school in, like, 3 weeks.
Yeah, but that's, like, closer to a month than not. That's, like, closer to the next full moon than not.
The 21st.
Whatever.
That's in
That's in, like, 20 days. That's in, like, less than 20 days.
Yeah, that's in 3 weeks. In 2 weeks. 2 Thursdays.
Do you guys want to hear us talk about the calendar more? Are you into it?
We're probably going to be a waning moon by that time.
Oh, that was fucking nerdy. I liked it. Any updates? Anything important we need to share, tell, laugh about, cry about?
No. Do you guys have anything? What are you looking for?
I'm looking for my phone.
Oh.
You know, I'm very important.
I will say, people seem bummed about the 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But people were also cool.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel every day of my life. Like, bummed, but cool, but...
It was a nice mix.
Yeah, so...
It was a nice little break. We had some things happening. Sarah is basically becoming, like, an interior designer. She's learning all the tricks of the trade. Her room refresh turned out gorgeous, guys. We love it. It looks so good.
I do wake up every morning and think I'm in somewhere else. Like I do every day. My room like drastically changed. I had like a god awful like minty colored room with just like plain white IKEA furniture. And now it's like a grown-up room. It's like a nice sage accent wall with like white walls and...
Oh, they're not white, Sarah. Say it. Tell the people.
They're sugar swizzle.
Sugar swizzle white.
Yeah, from Glenn Edwards. And I just got like... I bought like fancy... Well, it's probably not fancy, but it's like nice furniture from American Furniture Warehouse and a new bed. And I just like wake up and it's still so clean.
Well, and how many... literal bags of clothes did you get rid of?
Oh my god.
Whether it's for sale or for donate.
I can't.
Like, it's, we're talking more than, like, in double digits.
No, yeah, we are.
Yeah, don't fight
we
it.
We weren't at first. I donated them to a wonderful place called U-Mom, which helps mothers and children, like, nine.
Yeah.
Not grocery bags. That would
trash
be
bags.
Trash bags full. I have, like, a few more boxes that when I was putting stuff away. And, yeah, so I do feel good about that.
Good.
Melissa got a new closet.
I did. After 4 years of living in this house.
That's crazy. And she also went on a trip.
Yep. Took a little week-long shindig up to the Mitten. Loved it.
Spent, I was really hoping you would post on them on TMTM so people could see what you were doing.
From the lake?
Yeah, I just thought maybe you would do something like that.
I didn't want you to miss me any more than I knew you did.
I posted a selfie of me and Russ on there one day.
You did?
Yes.
Are you serious?
Painting away. Wait, me and Russ.
Russ was in the photo?
Yes. Oh. He turned around. I was like this.
Oh my. Are you lying to me?
Mm-mm.
Swear. You're such a shit. I was like, why didn't anyone tell me? Why didn't anyone message?
Didn't care.
I would have.
No, all you cared about was swimming.
I don't know if we told everybody. Oh, we did. I know we did. About the burn.
I don't want to talk about it. It was one of the worst times of my life.
Hearing you. Only because you had to put the lotion on it.
Well, you just got a very aggressive about the vitamin E oil.
Well, what's done is done. Now I'm a cool...
I can't forget it, though.
Cookie brown. I'm working on a tan.
Speaking of cookies, Crumple, get your shit together. You've had terrible tasting cookies for weeks.
Yeah.
Although I do want to try the cornbread.
Oh, you've never tried the cornbread?
No.
I've tried it. It was okay. You might like it. It's a little bit dry. Well, not like in moisture, like dry as in like it's a muted flavor that I think you would enjoy.
Well, that's just like Kentucky butter cake.
But Kentucky butter cake is sweeter overall.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Guys, do you want to know how I genuinely enjoy Sarah's company? And I proved it to her. I let her keep one of my frozen Kentucky butter cake cookies.
I ate it the next day and I completely regretted it because then I wanted another one.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I even left.
I ate all of them, so they're all gone. Don't ask me for any more. Don't touch my freezer.
Okay, let's get on with this.
Oh, guys, we missed you. All right, I do have new review.
Really?
Yep, pumped wow. about it.
I've been in my read aloud book era
yeah.
for the summer, so I have not been listening to podcasts, so I didn't look.
Yeah, I have to get back into it.
Well, and most of my other podcasts that I listen to now, I watch.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Son of a boy, dad.
Yeah.
That's it. No other podcast, just you.
Out and about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes I like to listen to the day before.
Sarah's a stoolie now, guys.
Oh, my God.
Sponsored by Barstool. Hit us up.
I wish. Did you see that girl yelling at Uncle D?
Yeah, Daddy D.
And all hail Svetlana.
Did you see her in the back? She said, no, you're ugly.
I loved it. I was like, I knew I started liking you.
It was really funny.
I don't
funny.
Love your Fashion Nova post, but I like you.
Yeah, I liked that.
And her name is Svetlana, not Svetlana. I just call her the wrong thing.
What can you do?
Because I didn't like her at first, but now I do.
Yeah, you've grown. She's grown on you.
She doesn't know me, but I know her. Okay, new review.
Yep, it's a 5-star review.
Of course.
Subject line? Bomb.
With an emoji or somebody just B-O-M-B?
Someone called TSA. It just says bomb. B-O-M-B.
Actually, speaking of that, I probably should have called somebody before this, but I was pushing up the garbage cans in my front yard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the UPS guy was like, yeah, well, that would be good, but if you really want to nuke them, you really would have to do, and then he saw me, and then we did a weird wave, and I was like, what is he talking about? Blowing somebody up?
He's probably talking about the microwave.
No, he wasn't.
Probably nuking some hot dogs or something.
No. There was more words that I can't remember right now that he said. But there was something about fertilizer. Like transmitter.
Oh, and, God.
it definitely was something suspicious.
It's like the New Girl episode where Nick freaks out that he thinks he's, like, gonna die. And he's like, I haven't contacted anyone to clear my internet search history. I wasn't gonna build a bomb.
Oh, yeah.
I was just curious.
Yeah. That was my UPS driver.
Oh, man.
Well, so, okay, so bomb.
Okay, bomb is the quote. No, but it's the subject line. Mm-hmm. This is from Sarah with an H, Stanley 14. Now, the only reason I'm saying both names is because it's in the review.
Also, thank God you have an H in your name.
Yeah, love that. She said, you ladies are so fun to listen to. Mm-hmm. One of my fave true crime podcasts. I love your relationship. And the cases you bring are so great.
Wow, thank you.
It's all we could hope for.
We're right? Beauty and we're grace. We're Miss United States. I'm doing something for the podcast, so don't yell at me.
Let's watch Miss Congeniality immediately after we record today. Okay, let's eat Chipotle, you go home, and let's watch Miss Congeniality in the next... before you go back to school.
I'll think about it. Oh, you're such a bitch. People heard that.
Is this thing on?
Including your mom. Aunt Lisa, that was rude of your daughter.
What are you looking up for the pod now?
None of your biz. Beeswax.
All right, I'll just like free flow. Oh.
Okay. I'm ready now.
I was going to freestyle.
Oh, it's time to rock, paper, scissors.
Ooh.
Haven't been practicing.
Me either.
Actually, I just saw this video that I'm sure everybody saw about these guys that were racing on bicycles. Have you not seen it?
I don't think so.
Okay, it's like these cyclists, like Lance Armstrong cyclists, and they're like neck and neck. Mm-hmm. And then you see them start talking to each other. They're trying to figure out who's... they know that they're going to finish at the same time, but like who's going to stand on the podium or something apparently, or who's going to win. I don't know. And they start playing rock, paper, scissors to decide. Oh. And who the guy wins in the first one. And he just like goes like, I swear, it looks like probably 1 foot faster than the other guy slows down. He keeps his pace. And they're like, oh, did they just rock, paper, scissors to who's going to be on the podium? So I was like, oh, so is that like for the third place, or will they technically tie because they're crossing close? I don't know how it works.
I don't know for sure, but I just know that when professional cyclists like race, they race as teams. So, you know, sometimes it'll be like 5 guys in the same jersey and like a different one will like go crazy and like ride as hard as they can to win that stage for the day. And then the next day, like another rider is like fresher. And then at the end, like one guy wins for that team. So maybe that's what they were deciding.
That's weird.
No, I thought when you were, because again, I'm 1,000 years behind the times. I thought you were going to say we should do the tortilla challenge with rock, paper, scissors.
That was funny. But no.
We'll just do regular old rock, paper, scissors today.
Okay. Ready?
But we're not going on shoot. On scissors.
Okay.
You ready?
Thank you for reminding me that.
Anytime.
Mm-hmm. Ready?
Rock, paper, scissors. Oh, I wasn't hitting it, but.
You won.
I win.
Why'd you get so scared?
Well, because I didn't know if I wanted to slap my hand.
And I think that has to be a redo. Because I think you saw me not move my arm.
Let's take a vote. Who votes? That's the case. One for two. That's no, you can't. Sorry, that's only 50%. You need a 50.1% majority vote.
Okay, squints.
Dude.
Melissa and I both have our glasses on today.
We look super smart.
But the thing is, I always wear my glasses. Melissa never wears her glasses.
Unless it's nighttime.
I don't wear my glasses all the time either. Well, I know I just said that, but I just have to say.
Well, you can, like, see, though. Like, you can do basic things.
Not on my left eye.
Like, if I don't have contacts in, I don't have my glasses on, I'm working with the 18 inches around my body at all times.
Do you think I just walk around without one or the other?
No, I think sometimes you, like, I think if you have your glasses on right now, I think if we went to dinner and your glasses broke, you'd be able to sit there and enjoy dinner with me. Even
yeah, like
your
this. With my hand to my pasta. I mean, my face to my pasta.
We're not getting pasta.
I know, but that's what I... Listen.
Okay.
That'd be the easiest thing to eat because it's all the same color.
Okay. I liked that theory.
Yeah.
I'll accept it.
I wear my contacts at work.
Yeah. Until about 3 p.m. when you go, oh, God, I got to get my car glasses on.
Because you know I put them in at 6:15. Now I'm going to put them in at my new vanity.
Cool new station.
I even added to it, so.
I stepped on one of my contacts. I don't know what you guys do with contacts, whoever wears dailies out there.
Throw them on the ground.
I just drop them wherever I am. I've started putting them on the dresser so I can just, like, scoop them up at the end of the week and, like, throw them away, which is probably disgusting for people who don't wear contacts. But I must have dropped one on the floor, and my house is all tile, including around my bed.
And it cracked?
No, I stepped on it and I thought I split like my heel open for a second. It was such an intense pain. It was fine. I was 100% fine. I was just being a little bitch about it.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel good. And I thought maybe I should take these out in the bathroom at night when I like brush and floss my teeth.
Yeah. Why don't you do that?
Because I don't think about it. And I get into bed, so and then weird. Before I go to bed is when I, but a couple weeks ago, I thought I got both of them out. Woke up with my right eye shut. Ironically, it's the one I'm having issues with now, so.
Melissa has an eye problem.
My eyelid is very swollen.
I think she got it from the lake.
I had my glasses on when Sarah got here, and I had texted her yesterday and said, I have a bit of an eye issue. If my eye look a little swollen tomorrow, don't be concerned. It's not, like, crusty or, like, anything. It's just, it's swollen. And you walk in today and you go, you look fine. And I took my glasses off and you went, oh.
There was a little bit of a shadow. I couldn't see it. That it's something. Okay, go ahead.
All right. Today, we're going to Austin, Texas. Yeehaw.
Texas?
Yep. It's August 28th, 1995. Staffers show up to the American Atheist headquarters. They find the door locked. That's not normal. Like, normally it's open by then. But there's a note on the door that says, hey guys, sorry the office is closed until further notice. We got called out of town on a family emergency. And it's signed by the founder's son. His name is John.
Do you think it said, hey guys?
Yeah. Why not?
Hello there.
I don't think any of you can fact check it. So sure. I think so. Oh, it probably said, hey y'all.
It probably said, howdy y'all.
Howdy doody y'all. We closed. Now John,
we fitting to open up after the,
it's fixing, not fitting. We fitting to open up. You're fitting to have a problem.
No. Okay.
Okay. So John ran the American Atheist Organization, a group that had been founded by his mother, a woman named Madeline Marie O'Hare.
Wow.
Have you ever heard of her?
Madeline O'Hare.
Madeline Marie O'Hare.
No, I don't think I did.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of background information on Mads.
Should I know her?
Not by name, but when I tell you why she's was semi-famous, you'll go, oh, I've heard of that.
Let me guess.
Okay.
Was she friends with Marilyn Monroe?
No.
Oh, 1995.
Well, she was aged in 1995. Was she
a model?
She was 76 years old. She was definitely not a model.
Somebody.
At some point she had been, but not somebody famous.
Oh, like a president?
She's famous.
Chicago O'Hare?
No.
Oh.
She's famous for political activism. Or something in that regard. For a court case. I'll just tell you. How about I just tell you?
Is it Roe versus Wade?
No, I'm not going to talk about that on this podcast.
Brown versus education.
Oh, that's a really good thought. But no, but you're getting closer. I'm not. Can I just tell you?
It's freaking rude.
Are you having fun guessing?
Those are the only two big court cases I know.
Oh, okay.
What's it? What is it?
Okay. I actually don't know if I even listed in here.
Melissa, why would you tell me that if you don't even
know? I probably do, because you'll know. So, obviously not. Madeline was born in 1919 to an upper middle class family.
Okay.
But when the stock market crashed in 1929...
Depression.
Yep. During the Depression, her family lost pretty much everything.
Dwight D. Eisenhower. Was it him?
you're just saying things.
It wasn't him.
I mean.
Oh. Teddy.
Herbert Hoover. Yeah. You were there. You were totally there. Dwight Eisenhower was only two presidents away.
I think they all look similar. Do they all have glasses?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
They look like us. Now. Eventually, Madeline would grow up. She'd go on to enlist in the military, and she was stationed in Italy in the Women's Army Corps during World War II. Mm. While she was there, she actually had an affair with a man named William Murray, who was an officer. Both her and him were married during their affair. And even though she would end up becoming pregnant with a son, he refused to leave his wife because of his strict Roman Catholic views on divorce.
Okay.
Now, Madeline divorced her husband anyways, and then she legally changed her name to Murray, even though she didn't actually marry the other guy.
That's creepy.
Which I was like, okay, stage five, like, you gotta let that go.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to marry you.
Did I fill out paperwork to change my last name to Efron? Maybe.
Did I explore the process? Who hasn't?
Yeah.
But,
You'd be crazy if you didn't.
Yeah, she did it. And, after the war, she got a law degree in Texas, and then she joined the Socialist Party because she didn't like how the American government was dealing with the Soviet Union. She even tried to emigrate to the USSR in 1959 and 1960.
She tried to go there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But they wouldn't give her son citizenship as well, so she never actually moved there. But she did try.
Most people probably want to come here.
Yeah, probably. Now, around this time, when she was trying to go there, her son William was in junior high, and he went to a public school in Baltimore. And Madeline did not like that the school included daily prayers. So she sued the school district on the grounds of separation of church and state. And that case ended up in the Supreme Court.
Is that what the case is called?
No, I didn't write it down. I think it's, I don't know what it is. But her case does eventually go to the Supreme case. It sounded like a Taco Bell order. It went to the Supreme Court, where they mandated a ban in an 8-1 vote on banning prayer in public schools, or like mandated prayer.
Yeah.
I said that terribly. I'm going to say that again.
But I think we got it. No, I do. I get what you're saying. They were banning that there was a mandated prayer.
Yes, that's exactly it. Okay.
They didn't say, hey, if you're feeling like it's time to pray, right now is the time and you can head off to room C and do whatever you want prayer-wise.
Yeah. They were like, oh, it's 10:14.
Bless us, O Lord.
Yeah. They just went straight into it.
Our Father.
You were just going to say the Lord's Prayer? Maybe that's what they said.
I'm going to guess back then that's what they said.
Probably. Now, because that led to all of the public schools stopping mandated prayers, she got pretty famous for being an atheist. She was an atheist. That was her belief. And she was on talk shows and interviews and all kinds of public forums trying to get God taken out of everything. She would at one point in her life also attempt to get In God We Trust taken off American currency. She wanted Under God, removed from the pledge. Like, she was just full out going for it. And because of that new fame that she had found after the court case, she founded the group American Atheists, and she moved the organization to Austin, Texas. And after her press tour in 1964, Life magazine actually dubbed her the most hated woman in America.
You know, I know who the ugliest person in the world is. It's Melissa, according to Andy.
Fucking Andy.
Andy told her that one time.
One time I mentioned offhand, like, we saw a picture of Andy, and it was like a blurry moving photo that like distorted his normal face. And I had said to our friend that was with us, like, oh, look, Andy looks like this person we know. And he just did not like that. And then like, didn't say anything, but like 5 minutes later, he just comes up and like puts the phone in my face and goes, well, this is what you look like. Mind you, the man was almost like 28 at this point in time, probably. And I like look at the phone and it's a Google picture, but the Google search is at the top and it says ugliest girl in the world. And I still like to give him shit about it because I'm like, what was that reaction? And he's always like, dude, I had feelings. I had to get it off my chest.
Yeah, you were mean to him. So he was mean back.
No, he was mean back.
Two wrongs don't make a right, Melissa.
Yeah, well, there was only one wrong that day.
Andy.
So it was just a wrong. Either way, she was the most hated woman in America. Yeah. If you Google it, you will find her. Now, while she was super unpopular in most circles, like majority of Americans, even to this day, are semi-religious. Like, they mm-hmm. believe in God. They don't mind God being a part of what obviously was the foundation of this country. And she was pretty unpopular with all of them, but she did have a lot of support from atheists all over the country and all over the world. And people started sending in money for the cause. And at one point, it's estimated that she controlled over $15 million in assets.
She just took them in?
She just
said, okay, I'll take your money?
Yeah, for the foundation. Like, and then what they would do is they'd hire lawyers to try and like get God We Trust taken off of the money. Like, because you got to have a lot of money to fight things like that. So which obviously that was never successful. But I don't know if all of that money had come in like during the 60s, but I did a rough estimate if it was that much money back in the 60s. Today that comes to being around $120 million.
Wow.
Yeah, so a lot of change. Eventually she'd get married again. At this time when she got married, she was Madeline Murray. Now she was Madeline Murray O'Hare. And she had another son named John. He was the man who had signed the note on the door. And then her first son, William, actually wasn't an atheist. And he had actually pursued Christianity and I think even becoming a pastor. And when he did that, she disowned him. So she wasn't cool with that. William had a daughter on his own, though. And then at some point, him and his daughter became estranged. And Madeline legally adopted her own granddaughter, who was named Robin. So she kind of like cut out her first son, but then adopted his daughter and because she wanted to be an atheist with her. Do you follow that?
Weird,
yeah, it's weird.
I got it.
Okay.
I'm picking up it.
Oh,
what you're putting down.
Oh, here we go. This is what I said next. So again, we've got Madeline running the show, her son John helping, also her granddaughter Robin, whose dad was cut off from his family for being a Christian. Boom. There's your recap. One of the employees thought it was weird, though, to have a note just from John, like, saying, oh, everything's closed till we get back. See you then. So he actually goes over to the house where Madeline lived, and he goes in. He finds breakfast food on the table and Madeline's medicine on the counter. He definitely thinks it's weird because he's like, this doesn't appear to be, like they packed for a trip or something. Mm-hmm. But it also seemed like a very last minute thing. So he's like, maybe it was an emergency and they truly just had to like drop everything and go.
I think the real question is, did the food, was it eaten at all?
He did not say.
Was it hot food or cold food?
And I guess hot.
Yeah, because back then.
Like eggs and toast.
Yeah, back then they used to eat that a lot.
Yeah.
Now people just eat chia seed pudding.
Sick.
I've tried to make it a million times and I hate it.
Ew.
Just the consistency is not for me.
My mom used to soak chia seeds in like a thing of water overnight, like a little shot glass of them, and then dump it in her morning smoothies and blend it up so it would be like the stuff from chia seeds, but not like gritty.
Have you seen that thing about the chia seed?
Chia pets? Yeah, no. I know. You into chia pets?
No, Melissa, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the detox people were. The internal flush or something. That's what it was called.
And I don't like that.
Apparently, you did a glass of water with like 3 tablespoons of chia seeds and then like lemon juice and like something else. And you had to like stir it up, let it sit so that they would get like a little bit congealed. And then you would have to chug it. And apparently, it just made you shit your pants.
I don't like that at all.
People tried it on TikTok. It didn't last very long.
You know, these TikTok challenges are a little out of control.
This was just like, hey, let me help you if you need help.
I just saw this story about 2 little angels. They're so sweet. These 2 little girls that attempted the blackout challenge and they accidentally hung themselves.
Oh, yeah. That happens all the time, sadly. Yeah.
Like, how are 8-year-olds on the internet without people knowing? It upsets me.
It's true.
Like, people, if you have kids, don't let them have a phone. I'm just going to say it. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
Put AirPod trackers. What are those air trackers called? Apple tags?
Mm-hmm. Air tags.
Yeah. Put those, sew them into your kid's shoe so they don't know it's there. Just completely invade their privacy. Don't give them a cell phone. Boom. Parenting 101. What's next?
So the breakfast food was out.
Yeah. We're assuming it's not chia pudding.
Yeah. Ugh.
After a few days of not hearing from them, though, one of the high-ranking board members actually gets a hold of John on his cell phone and talks to both him and Madeline. And John's like, sorry, we had to go so suddenly, but we're actually in San Antonio. We're all good. We're figuring out family stuff, and we're actually kind of doing a working vacation. We're just going to stay here for a little bit, and we'll, like, be in touch if we need anything. And so the board member's like, okay. And John's like, would you mind actually writing a couple of checks and sending them to me? I'm doing some business while I'm up here and I need to do like some whatever, like wiring some money somewhere to one of their other foundations. I guess they had multiple. I guess when you have that much money, you have like multiple foundations.
We do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she's like, all right, that's a little weird. But she mails him 2 checks for large amounts. He cashes them right away and then doesn't get back in touch with anybody.
A little suspicious.
Super. A couple weeks later, the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune pick up the story of the missing, you know, family. And I refer to them as like the Murray O'Hare family. I don't know if they all went by Murray or just O'Hare, but they start running stories about them and their organization. Because again, she is famous at that time. Because again, she was famous from like the 60s all the way through now, which we're into like the late 90s. Time goes by. Eventually, it becomes known that one of Madeline's other programs actually recorded a $600,000 loss on their income for 1995. And reports start coming out about embezzlement theories and fraud in the organization's history. And it moves on to the board of the American Atheists. And they eventually release an update that they believe John O'Hare had actually taken that $600,000 and then disappeared with it with his family. And so they say, we're going to file a police report for theft because we think he actually stole that money.
How is there that much money?
People have money.
I don't believe in it. I really don't.
Right. Or that like $600,000 would go missing on paper and like things would continue to function.
I don't think it's real.
Well.
I don't even think it's on paper.
Oh.
I think it's floating through the universe.
Well, money is a made-up concept by humans, but...
It really is.
I know. I'm with you. Over a year goes by, and in September of 1996, Madeline's estranged son, William, files a missing persons report on his mother, his brother, John, and his own daughter, Robin. And he's like, okay, things are out of control. It's been too long.
Yeah.
No one's heard anything. This is not normal. We gotta file the police report. But again... He's been estranged from his family. So it's not like he had day-to-day contact with them.
Yeah.
So I don't know why. It took a year. I always think that comes out sketchy, but I don't think it was in this case.
Well, maybe he talked to them on like certain holidays or different things like that. And he hadn't heard from them from like multiple birthdays or holidays.
Yeah.
Should I be defending him?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad thing. Okay. He's not a bad guy. Now.
Really would never.
A week later, authorities find Robin's car at the airport, but they have no idea how long it's been there. So a year after the disappearances, they finally manage to find a car. Overall, the case kind of goes cold because there's no evidence or forensics or really anything of any wrongdoing. And the case kind of heads to the back burner. And then in December of 1996, just a few months after the missing persons report was actually filed, the San Antonio Express News assigns a reporter named John McCormick to look into the case. And he goes through those weird tax returns where all that cash was missing, and then he decides to hire a private investigator to help with his investigation. The PI gets John Murray's cell phone records, and by looking at those, they can tell that during September of 1995, right after they were last seen, he was in the San Antonio area, and he was making calls to financial institutions, pharmacies, and jewelry stores.
Jewelry?
Mm-hmm. But those calls and everything just suddenly stops on September 29th, 1995. Like, phone disconnected, yeah. Never used again. John McCormick and the PI decide we need to find out what happened. So they start visiting every single one of those places Wow. that he called. Yeah. They start asking questions. They want to see if they can dig up anything new that no one's been reported yet. And then after an entire year into that part of their investigation, they end up at a coin dealer in San Antonio. And they find out that John Murray had acquired exactly $600,000 in gold coins and had paid for it in one payment.
Medallions?
Pretty much, yeah. Or
platoons or whatever?
Bullions, as Andy bullions. Likes to call them.
I call them platoons.
The supplier was like, yeah, he came in. He wanted 600,000 exactly of this.
So do you think they're like the size of a quarter?
Yeah. I think they probably like look like a
Peter Piper.
Like a Sacagawea coin is what I'm picturing. Maybe a little thicker.
Please.
Yeah, like Peter Piper. That could work.
You know?
Yeah.
You gotta have a lot of coin purses for that. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm cool. I think any decent human would, if you're gonna have that much coin, not exaggerating, you gotta have a treasure chest. You know, you can't just keep that like in the bank.
Do you have a miniature barrel?
Oh, that'd be cool.
No, do you have one?
No.
I do.
Oh, dude.
It's like this big. You don't have one?
Mm, no.
Like this? Like no. This? It's like a miniature barrel made out of wood?
No, I'm sorry. I don't. My barrel collection's running a little low these days.
I thought Papa gave them to us. Maybe I only got one.
Seriously?
I don't know. It was probably for my dad.
Mm.
He didn't really like you.
Oh, your dad did leave me a barrel. I forgot.
Let me go get it.
It's over here in my barrel room.
That was so funny.
That was so funny. yeah, I think you should have your coins in a treasure chest if you're going to have money in change.
Probably on wheels.
I mean, I'd like an old school treasure chest.
You're going to carry it?
I think you're going to have, like, swashbucklers carry it for you.
They don't have swashbucklers. They're not on the
sea. If you had that much money, you could. I wouldn't flee on a yacht. Actually, if I ever do have to flee, I should go on a yacht because I'd be the last place anyone would look for me.
Keep going.
All right. Now, so he comes in. He wants these coins. He pays for it all up front in one wire transfer. Pays for all 600,000. The supplier of the coins delivers 500,000 of those coins at a face-to-face meeting with John at a bank on September 29th, 1995. And that's the same day all his cell phone activity stopped. The other 100,000 that the coin dealer got, John never came in to get it.
Okay. You might not know this, but are these coins that are like fresh pressed or are these coins from like the Spanish era?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if they're a platoon or a bullion. I just don't know. And at this point, so when they find out this, which again has never been made public because the police did not get to this, a reporter and a private investigator did, they kind of put it together and they're like, there's only one reason that John would have left 100,000 on the table of those gold coins that he already paid for. And it means it's probably most likely because him, along with his mother and his niece, were probably dead. That's where they go. Yeah. Again, at this point, Austin PD has no new leads of their own that they've announced or that they're following. And again, I say or had announced because I just didn't find that in my research. In June of 1998, so almost 3 years after they go missing, an ABC News program runs a report that Madeline and her son and granddaughter had been staying at a local hotel in San Antonio from late August to late September 1995. They also report that Madeline had been spotted at a very specific bar multiple times and that John had sold his Mercedes to a man named Mark Sparrow for $15,000, even though the Kelley Blue Book amount for it should have been over $20,000.
Cars were that expensive back then?
I mean, it's the late 90s. It is a Mercedes. And then they say, so he sold that in like early September. Then in mid-September, they say John bought a diamond engagement ring from a local jeweler.
Who's he getting married to?
You don't say. Now, this man, Mark Sparrow, who bought the car, also says, basically, he tells everyone what happened. He's like, I saw an ad in the car. Like, that's not right. He saw an ad in the paper for the car. He calls. He talks to the guy who says, yeah, go to this hotel. It's in San Antonio. Check out the car. If you like what you see, come by this bar, the same one that Madeline had been spotted at. Ask for John, and we'll finish up the sale. So Sparrow likes what he sees. He goes to the bar. He meets with John. They agree on a price. They finish the payment. And then John drives and drops off the Mercedes at Sparrow's office. Easy peasy. Nice and done.
Well, they have to exchange the title and all that, so.
Exactly. But at this point, when Sparrow is shown a photo of John, he's like, who's that?
It wasn't John.
The real John Murray was like 6'2", 200 pounds, and he had super dark hair. And Sparrow says he bought a car from a guy who said he was John Murray, who was like 5'9", super tiny guy with curly, light-colored hair.
That's drastically different.
Huh. We've got an imposter on our hands.
Yeah, we do.
Now, the signature on the title transfer, though, did match the real John Murray's signature. So it's almost as if John knew what was happening, but somebody else. Yeah, so that's what
probably
they're thinking.
One of his squashbucklers or whatever you called them.
I said swashbucklers.
Oh, swashbucklers.
But I will now forever say squashbuckler. After that ABC special airs, a tip comes in through the tip line to John McCormack, who is the article, like, who's been researching all of this. And At this point, the man on the tip says that a guy from Austin named David and basically his like henchmen or like gang kidnapped Madeline, John, and Robin at gunpoint. And then he says David and these guys took the family to that hotel where Mark Sparrow had gone to look at the Mercedes, which I believe it was a La Quinta Inn, I think. But says they took the family to a hotel to hold them there. And then the tipster goes, I don't know this David guy personally, but I'm pretty sure his last name is Waters. And McCormick is like, excuse me, because he knows that name.
How?
David Waters was the office manager of the American Atheist Foundation from 1993 to 1994. In that time, he had embezzled more than $50,000 from the organization before he got caught and resigned. And then instead of him going to jail, he took a plea deal that kept him out of prison, but put him on probation.
How did he get...
I know.
What did he have to do for the plea deal? He didn't get any time in?
No jail time for the crime.
Probably because it wasn't aggressive.
Yeah.
What's that called?
Nobody aggravated?
Yeah.
Like a white collar crime?
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that some more in a bit.
Okay.
The tipster says another one of the kidnappers was a man named... Why are you laughing?
The tipster?
My newscaster voice?
Yeah.
The tipster said another one of the kidnappers was a man named Danny Fry. But he says, but Danny's been missing for a long time now. No one's seen him in a while. And originally, Danny had been keeping in touch with his brother named Bob back in Florida. But the calls were becoming fewer and fewer. And then eventually, the calls stop. Bob gets a letter from Danny saying, if I don't get in touch with you by this specific date, you need to call the police and give them David Waters' name. Justice. The last call that... The last call that Danny had ever made was on September 30th, 1995, just one day after the last call ever made by John Murray before his cell was turned off and disconnected. McCormick at this point just decides to go for it, and he just calls David Waters.
Hello, Davey.
Yeah, out of the blue. And he's like, hello, did you kill these people?
What?
Yeah, like just...
He's like that brazen with it.
Yeah, he just gets straight to the point, and David's like, no. Definitely not me. Like, don't know what you're talking about. Never been a part of that. Not me. McCormick then comes across a story later on the third anniversary of an unidentified corpse that had been found in Dallas County on October 2nd, 1995. A man had been, like, I guess, along a river looking for, like, aluminum cans to recycle when he comes across the naked body of a man who had both his hands and his head cut off. The description given of the body was very similar to the missing man, Danny Fry. Again, it's been 3 years since this body was found. McCormick convinces the county to test the unknown male's DNA against familial DNA of Danny Fry's brother and his daughter. Mm-hmm. In January of 1999, they get the results back, and it's a match to Danny Fry.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. On January 31st, 1999, the San Antonio Express News finally runs McCormick's article on the Murray O'Hare mystery.
Okay.
Almost immediately, an unidentified female contacts the FBI and offers to give them information about David Waters, Danny Fry, and the Murray O'Hare family in exchange for immunity. They label her as Confidential Source 2 or CS2 was how they... I guess, referred to her in all of their reports. And CS2 says that David Waters hated Madeline and numerous times had wished her harm. I guess Madeline had actually written an article in the July 1995 Atheist newsletter about how David had embezzled money and stolen from the foundation. And he basically loses his shit. He gets Danny Fry and another man named Gary Carr, both ex-cons, to carry out this abduction.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. CS2 then says that the three men were gone for a month from late August 95 to late September 95. And then they came back. And when they did, there was a lot of tension between Danny Fry and the other two men. And that eventually Danny Fry just disappeared and she never saw him again.
How does she know all this?
Well, she says she's clearly close to these people because she says his belongings never had been picked up. but it was weird. They just said that he wasn't coming around anymore. And then at one point she says she saw David Waters cutting up the shirt that she had seen Danny wearing on September 30th, 1995. CS2 also tells the FBI that David Waters had rented a storage unit at a self-storage facility during the fall of 1995. And the FBI sends a forensics team to the storage unit, the exact one that he rented. They find one teeny tiny drop of blood.
Oh.
And when they test it, it comes back and contains genetic material from both Madeline and her son, John.
Because they share the same DNA.
Oh, I guess. I was thinking they like had mixed, like blood had gotten mixed. Because, you know, sometimes they take a sample and you'll find multiple DNA strands in it. That's what I was thinking, but...
Why did you have to do that by yours also makes more moving sense. Your glasses? Like that?
Because it keeps slipping.
I know, but Melissa has like serial killer glasses on, kind of. Like they're like old school serial killer, except for the colorful sides.
There's a rainbow stripe on the side.
What are you talking about? The front part is definitely.
We have the same glasses on, don't we?
No, Melissa, mine are completely tortoise shell, and there is no metal.
Oh yeah,
yours are like the metal with the things at the top that serial killers used to wear, but the sides were black.
Used to.
And she keeps like pushing them up or like grabbing them and moving them up, and she's like, I'm gonna thought it was from there two types of blood mixed together.
I don't like wearing my glasses because my peripheral vision is not in focus, so if I keep my glasses pushed up as far as possible,
who are you looking at?
Myself.
Okay,
the main event,
go ahead.
Okay, CS2, she's like, hey, David Waters had that storage unit. They find the blood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At this point, it's been 3.5 years since all of the family had gone missing. By March of 1999, the FBI executes a search warrant on David Waters' apartment, and they find documents that belong to the American Atheist Foundation, a bow saw, and 119 rounds of ammunition. And as a former felon, it's illegal for him to own that ammunition, so they arrest him and they put him in jail with no bond. Next, they go to the apartment of his suspected co-conspirator, Gary Carr, who at this point is living in Michigan. And they find two loaded handguns, and since he's also a convicted felon, he gets busted and sent to jail as well. Carr immediately breaks when questioned by the FBI.
There's always one.
Puts up no fight. He says that David Waters planned it all. Carr admits that he flew to New Jersey with John to make sure that a wire transfer for the $600,000 would go through for those coins. And that he can prove what happened to the family. And he draws like a little map to an area on a 5,000-acre ranch, which is about 100 miles outside of San Antonio. And he says this is where the bodies should be.
Oh my God, that's a really good memory.
Yeah. And from April 2nd to April 5th in 99, the FBI searches the property for the bodies, but they find nothing.
Oh.
Yeah. At this point, David Waters is named as a public, like, suspect in the murders as well, but they take a different route to, like, keep him off the streets as they keep investigating, and he has actually given 60 years behind bars for breaking his parole.
Good.
Yeah, and it's ironically breaking the parole that stemmed from his embezzlement case of the $50,000 he stole from the foundation.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He didn't even go to jail for that.
Yeah. In December of 1999, a federal grand jury indicts Gary Carr on 5 counts. It's conspiracy to gain financially from a violent act, transporting stolen property across state lines, kidnap and robbery, extortion, and traveling interstate to commit an act of violence that resulted in death.
Jesus.
They don't indict him for murder, though, because, yeah, again, there's no bodies at this point. During Carr's during his trial, multiple inmates testify that had been cellmates of his up to this trial to the fact that he did admit multiple times he and Danny Fry had participated in the murder of the Murray O'Hare family, and it was under the direction of David Waters. They then as well say that Carr and Waters shot and killed Danny Fry after he started to freak out on them about the murders, and they didn't want the liability. So... then David Waters' ex-girlfriend of 7 years testifies and reveals in court that she's confidential source too.
Oh, girlfriend.
Yeah.
Ex-girlfriend.
So, but she had been with him when all this happened. So she testifies that she had found a bag in their closet that had three pairs of completely bloody sneakers, as if three people had been standing in a pool of blood for a long time.
Well, that's disgusting.
Terrible. Probably smelt so bad.
Wasn't even thinking about that. Mm. I just hate wet shoes.
Yeah, that too.
Like,
would you rather have to wear wet socks and shoes for the rest of your life, or every time you sit on a toilet seat, it's wet for the rest of your life? Now, the shoes is only when you leave the house. But every time, forever.
That's a question I'm not able to answer.
They're both so terrible.
Well, I'm just like thinking, it's like, I just go to the bathroom only at my house. So then it would only be whatever sweat was from me.
Oh, it could just be water. It doesn't have to be like from pee-pee or anything.
Girl, you're so disgusting.
I'm sorry I said pee-pee.
I don't know. I guess I'd pick the toilet then.
Yeah.
I hate wet shoes.
You could just stop using toilets altogether.
What would I use?
You could like squat over like a hole. Mm. Or like a bucket. Get like a chamber pot.
I live stand. In a home.
Well, I don't live in the 1500s, Melissa, so we're kind of attached to plumbing. But yeah, you just like pee in the shower when you had to.
Okay.
All right.
Please don't tell people what
we'll,
I do.
We'll strategize later. Also, again, sorry for saying pee-pee. So. Anyways.
We had to take a minor break because we couldn't get over the pee-pee.
Yeah, we needed a minute. Then in Gary Carr's trial as well, the prosecution calls three individuals to the stand. It comes out that they had a master key to all of the storage units. Ooh. They actually broke into his storage unit, David Waters' unit. Uh-huh, they found a black suitcase, so unoriginal, full of gold coins. There was about $420,000 worth of gold coins in the suitcase, meaning that the boys had only spent about $80,000.
And probably a suitcase has wheels.
It's got wheels.
Yeah, it's smart.
The three men spent every single dollar except for one of the coins. And they spent it on partying, strip clubs, and everything in between. They just blew it.
We would spend it on clothes, food.
Vacation.
Cookies.
Sarah. Diabetes checks, apparently.
Blood sugar checks. Insulin. Just kidding. I don't have diabetes.
But you said my sugars were high that day because I had like 2 crumble cookies.
I had eaten a lot of crumble cookies. I maintain that.
But like $420,000 in 95 was probably close to like, or more than $1 million. No, but it's a lot of money.
1 billion.
But imagine, also it's cash.
No, I know it. Well, it's not cash. It's gold coins.
You're right. Coin. Cash and coin.
It's a bullion.
Yeah. Y'all take bullions?
I got a lot of, see, they just open up the one of the zippered parts of their thingy. Never mind, my joke's not going. I can't remember the words of anything.
The suitcase?
Yeah. Just like, can you just imagine?
Just like, carrying a suitcase everywhere and it's like rattling.
Like when you have too many coins in your pocket.
Oh yeah, I've done that before.
I tried to get some coins out of the bottom of my purse today. All that came out was Excedrin.
Oh, I was going to say, like crumbs.
Nope, it was just Excedrin, not in a bottle. My bottle opened and there was, oh, I got so much down here. Pulled it out. It was like two just quarters of like Excedrin.
You know you're in your 30s.
I put them back in. Just back in the bottom.
You didn't put them back in the bottle?
I was going through McDonald's. There was too much going on.
Were you getting a Coca-Cola or an ice cream?
Coca-Cola.
Oh, was it good?
Yep.
Nice. Okay, yeah, so these people get up. They're like, oh, we found those coins right where, you know, it should be. We spent it all. Gary Carr chooses not to testify in his own defense. He's like, I'm going to sit this one out. And in June of 2000,
Y2K,
he's found guilty on all counts except for the conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Mm. He is sentenced to life in prison. And he's ordered to pay somewhere around $540,000 in restitution.
Which is like, where is he going to get that money?
Ironically, right. It's like, do you sell off everything that he has? And like, I just don't know.
But I don't think he has anything.
I don't know.
Because he put it in a black suitcase that somebody took.
Well, I also think sometimes now it gets included where it's like, Also, you can never make money off the rights to this story, or if anything ever comes of it, instead of getting paid, it goes to the victim's family.
I have seen that.
Maybe that's involved now. Oh, I just remembered what I wanted to say at the beginning of this podcast.
Say it at the end of the podcast.
I'm going to say it next week. It'll be just as important
next
week.
You're going to remember.
Oh, I'm going to make a note. Sorry, I said note. okay, so he's going to jail. Next up, David Waters. In September of 2000.
Y2K.
David Waters is indicted on all of the same counts as Gary Carr. David was a lifelong piece of shit. Terrible guy. In 1964, at the age of 17, David had been tried as an adult and sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison because he and three friends had beat another one of their friends to death. So not only when he stole that $50,000 did he not serve jail time, he had a prior conviction as a felon for murder.
That's what I'm saying.
On his rap sheet. Yeah. And they still were like, you're probably not going to do any harm out there. Mm-hmm. Texas, step it up. You know, Texas justice. Do better. Granted, this was like 30 years ago, but do better. Out of those 30 to 60 years, he served 12. So that's special. Waters later on in the 80s would serve more time in prison for fraud of some sort, which is where he meets Gary Carr, his future accomplice in extortion and murder. In the early 90s, Waters moves to Austin. He applies for a job at the Atheist Foundation for like typing, I think, or something. And he's very quickly, he's promoted to office manager.
Typing?
I think so.
Okay.
He's then promoted to office manager, and then he eventually steals over $50,000. Guess how he did it?
He just put one coin in his pocket a day.
Well, they didn't have gold coins at the foundation.
Oh.
They had checks.
He wrote a check to a dollar to him every day.
Semi.
$5 to him.
I don't know how, I mean.
$100.
I think he wrote larger checks, but yeah, he just straight up wrote himself checks. That was his big plan.
My mom still has a checkbook.
I have a checkbook. I actually have like four, because when you order new checks from Chase, you have to order like 100.
I have none.
You don't have any checks?
No.
How do you pay for things? Like your life insurance?
I have a job with the state. They pay for it.
I guess. We should get you your own policy.
I don't want to pay for anything.
Oh, I'll help you out. I'll get you a good policy.
You guys, this is a red flag. Red flag!
We could make Gussie the beneficiary.
Oh, no.
Makes you feel any better.
No, that doesn't. Not him.
Okay. So, I told you he wrote checks himself. Master plan right there. Mm-hmm. When he was caught, he does plead guilty to avoid jail time. And he got put on probation and had to pay back some of the stolen money.
Yeah,
he was
a jerk.
That was his big punishment. 4 months after his sentencing was when he abducted Madeline, John, and Robin.
How did he do that?
At gunpoint. We don't know the exact specifics. I'm imagining he did it at her home, which is why her things were out. Yeah. In January of 2001, though, right before his trial is about to start, Waters makes a deal with the feds in exchange for him helping find the bodies. So on January 24th, 2011, David admits to the kidnapping of the family and basically says that he convinced John Murray to do that wire transfer for the money because John believed that his mother and niece would be let go as soon as the money had been sent. Waters also admits that on September 29th, 1995, he, Gary Carr, and Danny Fry all participated in strangling Madeline, John, and Robin to death in that hotel room. And then they transported the bodies back to his storage unit, where they then decapitated and dismembered the bodies. I wanted to get that one over with in one go.
I don't like any of that.
It's horrible. Waters says that Carr is the one who actually cut up the bodies so that they would fit inside the storage drums. And then he's like, oh, Carr's also the one who shot and killed Danny Fry and mutilated his body to make it harder to identify. So that's all him.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI is like, yeah, that's bullshit. And if you don't tell us the truth, we're pulling the entire deal. they don't really fall for it. And he's like, oh, yeah, my bad. I got that little detail wrong.
Whoopsie daisy.
I actually was the one who killed Danny. And it was sort of my plan all along to do that.
Yeah.
He does stick to the part of his story, though, that he says Carr was the one who mutilated Danny's body. And then they both put Danny's head, hands, and clothes into a bag, which they disposed of back in Austin. Now, it's been a couple of days of questioning. It's January 27th, 2001. David Waters takes investigators to the same ranch that Carr had taken them to before, but this time they find the shallow graves. And they find the skulls completely intact and wrapped in plastic. The legs had been completely severed. And they also find a serial number on an artificial hip bone that matches Madeline Marie O'Hare. Now, what's interesting is they had dismembered them to fit in drums.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
I think they just used the drums to get them to this place where they were going to bury them. Because I saw photos of when they found the bodies and they were in the ground.
Yeah, I was about to ask that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I'm guessing that's probably easier as a transport. I know that sounds terrible, but it makes
Yeah, you can't be doing that kind of stuff outside. People will see. Dig teams eventually also find a fourth set of remains.
What?
That include a skull and hands, which they match to Danny Fry using dental records.
Okay.
And because of the extortion charges, a judge decides to add 20 years to his already 60-year sentence for David Waters.
Good.
But then because, you know, he's got 80 years in front of him and he'll officially already die in prison, authorities decide to not go through with a trial for the murder of the Murray O'Hare family. So nobody was ever actually charged with that.
Yeah.
And on January 27th, 2003, just 2 years after he admitted what happened, David Waters died of lung cancer at a medical center in North Carolina. And I couldn't find out anything about Gary Carr. I know this is a couple years ago. He was still imprisoned in Illinois. I looked today on Illinois Inmate Finder and I did not find him. So I don't know if he had a different name or a spelling or something. Those systems are so finicky. So he's either, I'm assuming, still in prison or has also passed away. In 2017, though, Netflix did a documentary kind of movie on Madeline Murray O'Hare, and they called it Most Hated Woman in America. So it was a Netflix special. You guys can go watch it still if you want. And Madeline's living son, William, said that he hadn't been contacted by anybody at Netflix for the film, and that he believes that the info they used on her personal life or her personal, like, the way that she was, they think they just used doing a Google search. So that was kind of a bummer that, you know, they made a movie about his family and didn't.
I heard that's actually a problem these days.
No, that's not cool.
I saw this other girl that was, I don't know who her sibling was or what, but she literally, like, got on to a plane flight and saw a documentary that her and her family, like, currently were in a lawsuit against, somebody who did it about her sister's death. And, like, she contacted Delta, whoever it was. I don't know who it was.
Yeah.
But for some reason, that makes me think it. They ended up taking it off.
Jeez.
But, like, you can't. You can't just, I mean, you can, because it's freedom of press and speech, but it's not always the most polite thing for people.
Yeah, I think you should definitely have someone at least reach out to surviving family and at least say, like, hey, this is going to be happening.
Exactamundo.
Ready for some photos? This is Madeline Murray O'Hare. She wrote a book called Freedom Under Siege. And it says, the impact of organized religion on your liberty and your pocketbook. So that was her big draw. That's her. That's Madeline.
Mm.
Right. Remember, she was 76 when she was abducted and murdered. So she was older. This is a picture of Madeline with her son, John, and then her granddaughter / adopted daughter, Robin.
I was wondering how old she was. The Robin.
Yeah. I would say she looks like she's like young 20s, if even.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know if this is cool to say for any movie people out there. I personally think that John Murray resembles the man in Happy Gilmore, who is like the tall guy with the dark hair who like basically kicks the shit out of Shooter McGavin at the end of it. I think they look very similar if you're a movie person. you might find the same. This is John McCormick. This is the investigator, like journalist, who essentially solved this case.
Exactly.
Like,
without him, none of it would have been figured
out. Yeah, kept on it. I couldn't find a video or a photo of the private investigator. I know his last name was Young. Uh-huh. So, but I didn't find a photo of him. This is Danny Fry. So that's one of his prior mugshots. He was also a murder victim by the end. This was Gary Carr.
Thank you.
And this was David Waters.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Those are my photos. And that is the story of the sometimes referred to American Atheist murders.
Wow, very nice.
Thank you. It was a long one.
Thank you for that. Melissa, that looks like a lot of pages. You said it's gonna go so quickly.
Well, it's just been so long since we hung out and like did this, and I wanted everyone to like really get their fill.
Yeah, I totally get that. Perfect. May I pee, please? Pee-pee, please?
I was like, if you say it right. Hold, please.
A boom. Time?
Yoop. That's the phonetic spelling of yoop. Yep.
Oh, yoop. I didn't understand. All right. While you were gone, I don't know if you noticed because you aren't on social media when your place is, I put up, hey, give me some ideas for stories.
Did you and Russ put this up together?
Yeah, me and Russ. We took it. It was actually the background.
Got it.
Russ is a true crime fanatic. So, just kidding. I don't know. Russ wasn't as talkative this time around.
Oh.
But I also stayed away from him. Because he's painting.
He had a job to do.
Yeah, I didn't want to be like, I just kept saying, Russ, you sure you don't want a Powerade?
You didn't want to be like, hey, bud, I know you already painted all the baseboards in this room.
Okay.
But you didn't fully listen to instructions and you got to do it again.
It was a miscommunication. It was fine. The reason why I talked to him more the last time was because he was walking around the whole entire house doing different parts. Yeah. This time it was like I was specifically in the family room and he was in the other parts of the room.
Got it.
Of the house. Whatever. It doesn't matter. So I asked for some story ideas.
Not so, from Russ, from our listeners.
Yeah, sorry. Melissa just gave me gummy bears and they made me a little burpy. And Tara, as always, came through.
Always, TB.
Yeah, so she gave me like multiple, so I just picked one. And what was awesome about it too was she was like, the first one sounded really cool. The second one seems confusing, but cool, which is of course the one I then picked, I think. And then like, third, like she gave me like a brief thing like, just read the headline, like, you know, different things. So,
dude, Tara
I decided
through.
Yeah. So I decided to pick one of hers. And what I did was I picked the one that is supposed to be the perfect crime.
What?
At least that's what was hoped by.
Hoped for.
It was hoped by.
All right.
So I'm going to tell you about Nathan Leopold. L-E-O-P-O-L-D. Leopold.
Leopold.
Like Leonardo DiCaprio.
But no Arno DiCaprio. Just pulled.
Yep.
Got it.
Exactly.
Hold the Arno DiCaprio.
Richard Loeb. L-O-E-B. Lieb.
Loeb.
Loebed.
Leb.
Richard L.
Ricky L.
I knew a person with the last name of Lieb.
Right,
but Leo it wasn't spelled and Ricky. This way. I refer to them as Nathan and Richard.
Oh, okay.
Because I knew I would mess up their last names.
Got it.
But I know I can't mess up Nathan. I know I can't mess up Richard because it was my dad's middle name.
Right.
So they were both born in Chicago, Illinois, and they were like super duper smart.
Love it.
Yeah. Nathan was born on November 19th, 1904. To a wealthy German Jewish immigrant family. He was said to be a child prodigy, and apparently he spoke his first words at only 4 months old. That's a strong apparently.
Yeah, that's a big one.
But what Wikipedia says is what we say.
Yeah.
You know, along with other things too, but that's my first source, you know?
Always.
Now, Richard was born on June 11th, 1905, also to a high-class family. His His father.
Yep.
His father was a retired vice president of Sears. And, like, I guess when he retired, he decided he wanted to become a lawyer as well. So that's what he did. And Nathan, or Richard, like Nathan, was also extremely intelligent.
Wait, so his dad retired and was like, now that I'm retired, I'm going to become a lawyer?
Apparently. Mm. Oh, here's another thing, listeners. Listeners across the world. I wrote this about a week or so ago.
Oh, right.
I haven't looked at it since.
Okay, got it.
Don't remember much.
Tara, fill me in.
Yeah. Also, I did listen to something online that this girl was like, yeah, the like podcast fog is like real. Like, we don't remember what we said. We don't remember like what story we talked about. We don't like, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's true.
Yeah.
Because I, half the time, if I listen to like our podcast after, I'm like, I don't remember that.
Yeah. Tiffany texted me last week just the words persona non grata with like multiple laughy faces. Yeah, and I was
you
like,
told me that story and I don't know.
Yeah.
What
and
means.
I was like, what were we talking about? Why? Like, what part was that from? Like, I couldn't remember just now when you mentioned Tara. I'm like, oh, Tara suggested that insane story of that lady in Phoenix who like murdered that man in a wheelchair and like put it, set him on fire behind the church. But I can't remember that lady's name. And she's fucking bananas. But yeah. Like, it happened.
Totally.
The fog is real.
Yeah. Okay. So basically both boys were super smart, but it said that, They said that Nathan was like prodigy smart. Richard was just like extremely smart.
Oh, how embarrassing.
So it's basically me prodigy, you Richard.
That's me.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nathan and Richard both grew up in that like fancy, affluent Kenwood neighborhood, apparently, which is on the south side of Chicago. And they both had summer homes in Castle Farms, which is in Michigan. So fancy smancy.
Yeah, vacation homes.
Exactly. They did know each other from like the neighborhood area, but they didn't start hanging out until the mid-1920s when they were both at the University of Chicago. Now, they're born in 1905.
Yeah.
They're going to college early. Prodigy style.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wrote, I mentioned that both boys were smarty pants McGee's.
Yeah.
Which I usually say that as like when somebody's being sassy in my class. I'm like, oh, okay, smarty pants McGee. Because it makes me feel like I can be rude to them when I shouldn't. You know?
In like a cool way.
Yeah. Apparently, and I keep saying this because who really knows?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if I believe that somebody spoke at 4 months old. Do you?
I mean, I think there are some, yeah, I think some children are geniuses. I think Baby Geniuses is a movie for a reason.
4 months?
I don't, Sarah, I don't know when kids learn tricks. I'm a bad person to reference this with.
Okay. Nathan studied 15 different languages. He spoke 5 of them fluently. He planned to attend Harvard Law School after graduation. He had been nationally recognized as an ornithologist, the study of birds, ornithologist. The study of birds,
got
fancy
it.
Bird man.
Like you.
Oh my God.
No wonder you gravitated to this story. It's you flocked funny. To it.
It little... Go flamingo over there. Are you feeling peckish for dinner?
Dude, yeah.
So you get peckish, though. That's a bird thing.
I know.
Oh.
Just because I'm not a savant or a prodigy doesn't mean I didn't get your pun.
So he, like, studied birds all the time, and he made observations about some sort of bird called, like, a brown-headed cowbird, and it apparently was, like, a big discovery, and, like, people knew him in the bird-watching world.
But what a terrible name. I hope he didn't name it, because that's not a great name.
I don't think so.
Got it.
Richard, the second boy, he had skipped many grades. He became the youngest to graduate at the University of Michigan at age 17. And after graduating there, that's when he then moved to the University of Chicago, where he was going to go to law school.
Hmm.
So they both are now at the University of Chicago.
Got it.
Becoming friends. And in talking, like so many of us, they realized that they were into crime. I think they just called it crime, not true crime. And Nathan was extremely interested in this concept from this like German philosopher. with a crazy name. Basically, it sounds like it's Frederick, but in a German spelling and
pronunciation.
Nietzsche. It's a German philosopher.
Nietzsche?
That's probably right. Nietzsche. That's a lot, though, yeah. For such a short...
Nietzsche.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Basically, this concept in German would translate to the word Superman in English, or Superman. And it basically was based off the fact that there are people in our world so smart that had this, like, extraordinary and, like, unusual capabilities that would allow them to think and rise above, like, rules and laws that normal people couldn't. Basically, it sounds like somebody is so psychotic that they believe everything they're doing is... It's like a psychopath. They're getting away with things. They're smarter than everybody. Nobody's ever going to catch them. But he was obsessed with it. And he believed that he and Richard, or Nathan believed that he and Richard could do the same due to their intelligence. And he wrote a letter to Richard explaining that, quote, a Superman is on account of a certain superior qualities inherent in him, exempted from the ordinary laws which govern men. He is not liable for anything he may do.
Oh.
So, like, he also thought apparently this concept thought that the person was so smart that they couldn't be held responsible for what they did either.
That's a fun little thing to sneak in at the end.
Yeah. Again, it's you're found not guilty by
right.
mental instability or whatever that's called. What's that called? Insanity. Mental. What?
They have different things of doing it, but you can be guilty or not guilty by reason of like mental like defect. Or...
Yeah, but there's a word. It's all the words that we're saying, but in a different order.
Let me see if I can... Not guilty by reason of...
Everybody knows it.
I mean, they say insanity.
Yeah.
Or...
Like they can't take the stand due to...
Obviously, we're not getting away with that one.
or
we are.
You guys know the word we're saying because we know the word. We just don't know it.
One time during an MFM, the girls couldn't remember the word trophy for talking about like souvenir by a killer. And I was fucking livid in my car.
It's right now what people think.
They're probably defect or insanity.
No.
I'm just going to keep
saying
the same.
Mental instability. No.
Anheuser-Busch.
It's something like.
By reason of mental.
Okay, we know what it is, and it's going to come up, and we'll figure it out, and we're not going to be upset about it. We're just going to be calm, cool, and collected, the three C's.
Yeah, I'm just going to Google it real quick, quietly. You keep talking.
Yeah, but this is serious.
I'll do it.
Okay, so Nathan's like, Richard, this is what this concept is. Are you in? And Richard's like, okay, sure. So they started out slow and low. Did you find it?
I mean, one of them says not guilty by reason of mental defect.
Okay, I think it's just a different word.
And the other one just says not guilty by insanity.
I think that's it.
I said that like 9 times.
I think it's both of those that we both said.
I think we just split them up.
I think we need help. Okay. So they started off low and slow, as I was saying. They decided that they were going to steal and vandalize to start out. And they started by breaking into like a fraternity house at the University of Michigan where Richard used to go to school. And they stole like pen knives, a camera, typewriter, just like regular stuff.
Okay.
And from there, they didn't really get the nobody made a big deal of it.
Right.
Also, who's going to make a big deal of it at a frat house? Things get, well, maybe not back then, but like stolen, taken, misplaced.
Yeah. They were probably so busy. Like, oh man,
I lost. Keg stands, bro.
Well, I was going to say like.
Kappa-thai kata. Throwing parties and.
Oh, I was going to say they were busy out like escorting girls to like the fair or like.
Oh, because we're in the 1920s.
That's what I was thinking.
I was in the 2005s.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they were doing. Yeah. They're busy. So they weren't like super excited because nobody cared really about it.
Bummer.
So they then moved on to arson.
Oh, a natural jump.
And again, with the arson, with the arson, they weren't getting coverage from it. Like, nobody cared again, and they just were like, guess we have to do more.
Bombs. I just thought I'd try to guess it.
Have you been hanging out with the UPS guy from my neighborhood?
Wally?
I don't know, but that... I don't know what his name is. But he was on speakerphone, so he couldn't be, like, trying to do something crazy, because why would he be on
speakerphone? Maybe he was trying to impress you.
No. I didn't want to look at him. I should have, though. All right. So, in their outrage and frustration, they decided that they needed to plan what they would call the perfect crime. And that would get public attention. And it would confirm their status as the, quote, supermen of that concept.
See, they're already stupid because the perfect crime would garner no public attention. Idiots.
Okay, but they're, like, super smart.
But don't you agree?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, they don't know anything.
Like my UPS guy. Nobody's going to know he's the one that blew something up.
Not if they get rid of the witness.
That's me. They don't know where I live. He didn't drop a package off at my house. Just my neighbor across. My neighbor across the street, a police officer. He heard this it.
This goes all the way to the top.
All right. So I just want to update you right now that Nathan is 19 and Richard is 18 at this point. So still youngins. And they decided that their perfect crime would be to kidnap and murder a young boy.
What? Why? Why do we have to go that route? Fucking A.
So they spent 7 months planning their crime. They focused on how they're going to kidnap the boy and how they would... What did I do?
You said focus. That's what you did.
I fixed it.
You recovered so well, but I couldn't. I was just picturing you going, fuck yes. Like, speaking German, it was a whole thing. I just got excited.
Okay.
What did I do?
Let me. I shouldn't have had any of those gummy bears because I can't stop thinking about them either.
You can't focus on anything.
No. Fuck off. All right.
Fuck off.
Melissa, this isn't funny.
Okay.
So they were focusing on how they were going to kidnap and later dispose of his body. They also decided that they would hold the boy for ransom first. What are you doing? Can you see me?
I can see an outline of you. I can see your hair versus your face.
Oh, see? You were looking for something.
Yeah, I was going to get some on meds.
Gross. They were going to, oops, my light dimmed. They decided that they were going to hold the boy for ransom, and they decided that their plan must be complex in that. So sounds freaking stupid. They're making it worse. The pair searched for who they believe would be their perfect victim at the Harvard School for Boys in Kenwood, which was actually where Nathan had gone to school. It sounds like it's just like a fancy boys school.
Yeah.
And Nathan and Richard found their victim in a boy named Robert Bobby Franks, who was 14 and came from a wealthy family.
Bummer.
Now, this is kind of weird. A few weird things. One weird thing is that I found that Bobby was also Richard's second cousin somehow. And that, like, lived on Richard's same street and had, like, gone over to Richard's house to, like, play tennis and, like, different things. So, like, they knew who he was because it's where Nathan had gone to school. It was in their area. So that doesn't sound like a great person to take.
Maybe they decided to split up the part of it. Like, you pick the area and then you pick the person. And he was like, well, let's go somewhere I know everything about. And then he was like, oh, I know someone who lives there. He borrowed my Legos and never gave them back. You know,
tennis racket. Those things are expensive, too.
Not cool.
People are really getting into pickleball lately.
Yeah, that's a big thing in the senior community. I have a couple of clients who are pickleball champs.
Yeah.
They send pictures.
People are playing it naked now.
Why?
Lindsay told me.
No, why would you go there from me telling you about seniors playing pickleball? Why do you segue to the Nike?
Because we have a couple that comes into my other work on Saturday that play pickleball. And we were telling them about it. And they're like, oh my God, a million people sent us that article today. They don't play it naked. But they do come out here to play.
All right.
Okay. So Bobby Frank's 14. He somehow is related to Richard. He lives on the same street as Richard and his family. They had played tennis together at some point in their life. It did not sound like they were very much attached, but to the point where they're like, oh, a neighbor, or oh, yeah, a second family member that they didn't spend a lot of time with. So on May 21st, 1924, Nathan and Richard rented a car under the name of Morton D. Ballard and offered Bobby a ride home from school when they had seen him walking home. Bobby was just two blocks away from his home, so he immediately was like, oh, no thanks, I'm super close, thanks anyway. But Richard started talking to Bobby about a tennis racket, and he convinced Bobby somehow in talking tennis with him to get into the car.
Sad.
Yeah. Supposedly, Nathan was driving, and Richard was actually in the back seat, and Bobby was sitting in the passenger seat. And from the back seat, Richard hit Bobby in the head with a chisel multiple times, pulled him to the back seat where he gagged him, and Bobby ultimately died.
This is a terrible plan.
I know. It's also a terrible story, Melissa.
I hate it.
Richard then placed Bobby's body on the floorboard of the back of the car so he wouldn't be able to be seen. And they made their way to Wolf Lake in Hammond, Indiana, which was about 25 miles outside of Chicago. Once it was night, they removed and threw away Bobby's clothes and placed the body in a water tunnel near the Pennsylvania Railroad tracks to the north of the lake. So not in the lake, but near it. Like in a water tunnel. You know, like
a canal?
Kind of, but it's like ones you would see in the olden days that were like circular. Somebody recently came out of one in a TV show I was watching.
Like a drain pipe? Like a big one?
Yeah, kind of. It seemed like it was that.
Okay. It probably funneled overflow from like canals or whatever into the lake.
Yeah. Oh, the TV show was Scandal.
Mm.
Yeah. So they just put him in there. This is awful. They then poured hydrochloric acid on his face and other parts of his body in hopes to disguise Bobby.
Fuckers.
I know. By the time Nathan and Richard returned to Chicago, Bobby had been reported missing because it was then nighttime.
Right.
Nathan called Bobby's mom, saying he was a man named George Johnson and that her son had been kidnapped. He told her that there were instructions for the delivery of the ransom and they would be coming in the mail. The pair then typed up a ransom note using a typewriter that they had stolen from that fraternity, and they put it in the mail to be sent to Bobby's mom. They burned all their bloodstained clothes, cleaned up the rental car, and then spent the night just hanging out and playing cards. The casual. Gin rummy.
Casual stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The next morning, Bobby's family received the mail. Nathan then called them one more time and gave them more instructions about how to pay the ransom. So basically, he's like, did you get it? Did you get my invitation in the mail? Like,
seriously.
You know, like, that's, like, what he's doing. It's like, why are you doing that?
Continuing to insert themselves in
exactly.
it. Exactly. Got
it. Now, Bobby's family obviously followed the instructions, but one of their family members who was helping them actually wrote down the address wrong of where they were supposed to go to receive, like, their next directions. And that obviously, like, messed up what was going on. But by then, Bobby's body had actually been found. Mm-hmm. So it kind of like didn't matter.
Right. Because they weren't getting him back.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they were like, they didn't realize it was wrong. And then.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, not whatever, but.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Nathan and Richard then continued to cover their tracks. They burned the typewriter that they had used and another blanket they had used when moving Bobby's body. And they just went on with their day-to-day lives. The Chicago police started an investigation into Bobby's death, and they offered a reward for any information. Richard stayed quiet. He just lived his normal life. But Nathan could not help himself and, of course, went to go speak with the police and reporters, giving ideas and theories to basically anybody who would listen to him. He went as far as telling a detective, quote, "If I were to murder anybody, it would be just a cocky son of a bitch as Bobby Franks was."
Not a cool dude.
No, it's just like, also,
and you're not smart, to be smart. Dude. Yeah. But like at the end, they're still children, essentially. Yeah,
exactly.
I feel like that's a thing that when kids are super smart, like savant level, like, unfortunately, they don't get treated like children in the same way that they should, because even though they're super smart, they don't have the emotional, like, awareness of things. So when you just treat them like, oh, you're so smart, you're so special, like, as an adult, they don't.
Well, and it's like, then you focus on all the things that they can learn and do, and they don't learn just, like, the normal day-to-day things of, like, how to talk to people, how to play with people.
Well, if they're that smart, their brains are clearly different. They might, it sounds like they were missing the emotional connection piece with normies. Like you and I. Muggles, if you will.
Yeah, that sounds great. All right. Now, also during the investigation, when they had found Bobby's body, they also found a pair of eyeglasses near them. And the prescription was pretty common. So it's probably like my type of prescription, not yours. But the frames were fitted with some unusual like hinge. And it was found that this hinge was only used and put on the... That's weird to say. It was found that this hinge was only purchased by three people in Chicago. And one of them was Nathan.
Ew. Idiot.
His freaking glasses fell out of his pocket.
Were they...
Spoiler.
Were they clear with metal going across the top?
Uh-huh.
Did they have a rainbow stripes?
Nathan was brought in for questioning, and he told the police that he had been bird watching.
Oh.
Yeah. He had been bird watching, and his glasses probably fell out of his pocket. So probably when he saw a bubble-headed brown cow or whatever.
He's like, I'm sorry. I'm a study of ornithology, and I just leave things around. This brown cow.
Oh, my God. I bet you he put them down there because he wanted the crows to bring him stuff. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I do know about that, and I believe in it. And
I don't like crows.
If I wasn't afraid of birds, and particularly crows / like ravens that are like because of PTSD from Flagstaff.
Yeah, I was about to say, think of those ones.
Yeah, like I think it's pretty cool when they like you can teach them to like bring you back money and for shiny.
Yeah,
birds.
But then you're making them into thieves.
They're animals. I don't think they have
They've got the with-itness.
The with-itness?
Yeah, isn't that what it's called?
The wherewithal.
I think it's both, actually.
The with-itness.
I think with-itness is a word,
though. I think you
have
to have intent to commit a theft, though. And I don't think animals are capable of that.
You would become that person. The ASPCA would come after you.
First of all, they'd be lucky to have me. That'd be a wonderful addition.
No, they're going to put you...
But I'm not about PETA. I think there are a lot of... I think people who support PETA are good people, but I think a lot of PETA is in it for the wrong reasons.
Totally.
I said it.
All right.
Okay.
No, that's why we don't have circuses.
Do you have a problem with that? Or do you like
that? I used to like to go to Barnum Bailey's.
Oh, okay.
As a child.
Got it.
Didn't like the clowns, but who does?
PETA just puts an enormous amount of animals down every year instead of paying to, like, take care of them.
Okay. So it's getting political. It's getting political. I was trying to put PETA in it, but it didn't work.
Petilical.
Didn't work. Okay. All right. The glasses, they're Nathan's. Nathan was searching for the birds. They fell out of his pocket. Now, on May 29th, both Nathan and Richard were brought in for formal questioning. Their story was that on the night of the murder, they had actually picked up two women in Chicago using Nathan's car and then dropped them off near a golf course, but hadn't learned the woman's last name. So they had just given them very common names for that time.
Mm-hmm.
But their story was screwed. I wrote that. Their story was screwed when Nathan's chauffeur was questioned, and that he actually said, well, that's not true because I was repairing the family car that night.
Ooh.
And my wife actually can also corroborate this story because we had it at our home and I was fixing it and she saw it.
Once again, perfect crime.
Exactly.
No.
So Richard confessed. He said that Nathan had planned the whole entire crime, that he had been the one that killed Bobby in the back seat while he drove. And then quickly after that, Nathan too confessed, but he did the opposite, saying that Richard had killed Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
Their confessions aligned with all the evidence found. It was brought to the state's attorney's office on May 31st. And on June 7th, the burned typewriter was found like in a lagoon where they had thrown it. So they had one extra piece of evidence. Also a lagoon. It's freaking cool. Nathan and Richard's trial was held on the Chicago Cooks County Criminal Court, becoming this huge media spectacle, labeling it the trial of the century.
Yeah.
Getting what they wanted. Richard's family hired a well-known defense lawyer named Clarence Darrow, and it was rumored that he was paid $1 million.
In the 20s?
Yeah. But later it was only $70,000. But in 2021, that would equal $1.100.100.
Okay.
How much is that? Like $1 million?
Yeah, it's like the equivalent of $1 million.
Exactly. It's believed that both Nathan and Richard's defense would be that... Oh, my God. They're not guilty by the reason of insanity. That's what I was fucking trying to remember.
Whoopsie.
That's what I was trying to say. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but I also disagree with that verdict.
I know, but that's the word. I'm saying, does that word make sense to you?
Yeah, I think if we went back and listened, we'd hear us say insanity multiple times.
I don't know.
But I think we were trying to put them together by mental defect.
This was an Anheuser-Busch situation.
Yeah.
Totes.
Anheuser? Bush Woozer.
No, I just kept saying Schmam Schmeider Bush or something. I kept like just doing it wrong. Okay, who cares?
Like you said Clydesdales the other day?
They are Clydesdales.
Clyde. You said Clyde.
Clydesdales. That's what they are. Okay. So the word we had been looking for, or the term reason, not guilty by the reason of insanity. Due to the fact that basically they were like, oh, if this goes to jury trial, like the defense attorney was like, if you go to jury trial, you're done for. Yeah. You're getting death penalty.
Yeah, for sure.
You're out of here. So we're going to put you in as not guilty, both of you as not guilty by a reason of insanity because.
Mm. Oh, you were saying that was their strategy.
Yes.
I thought you said they were found. That's how they were found. No. And that's why I was like, well, I disagree with that.
No, I see.
Okay, got it.
It was believed that their defense would be.
Got it.
That's what it was because the defense attorney, Dara, was like, you're dead in the water.
Yeah.
Basically. Yikes.
Seriously, like Bobby's dead, a child.
Uh-huh.
And not only that, he was murdered for sport by two rich kids with nothing better to do.
Yeah, you had extreme intent.
Like, yeah,
you planned it for 7 months.
Yeah, fuck
buddies.
You.
All right, so then something changed, and I don't know what it was, but then their defense changed, and their idea changed, and the attorney, Darrow, decided that they would go in with a guilty plea, hoping that they would get life sentences instead of the death penalty. So something must have happened, or something was talked about between the state and the defense attorney, and that was hope. I think basically there was so much evidence against them that there was just nothing, whatever. At the end of the trial, attorney Clarence Darrow gave what would be called the finest speech of his career, which lasted 12 hours, and basically focused on the justice system being inhumane and how young the men were and how immature they were when they committed the crime. So basically he's just trying to get rid of the death penalty at all.
Yeah, he's filibustering at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he wore a diaper.
Well, I wonder if it was like the judge was finally like, let's pause.
Yeah.
Till tomorrow. I don't know. On September 10th, 1924, the judge sentenced both Nathan and Richard to a life sentence in prison and an additional 99 years for the kidnapping of Bobby Franks. So basically, never getting out.
Yeah, ever.
Nathan and Richard were initially held at the Joliet Prison. They were kept apart as much as possible, but they could maintain a friendship. They were at the same prison.
That's not good. Did they try to escape?
No.
Oh.
In 1931, Nathan was transferred to Statesville Penitentiary, and then later Richard followed. When they were back together, the two created and expanded a prison school system. They, like, did good shit.
Okay.
Like, they created basically a prison school system teaching high school and junior college curriculum because they were, like, so smart.
Yeah.
On January 28th, 1936, Richard was attacked by another inmate with a razor and later died in the prison hospital. Mm-hmm. He had over 50 wounds that included defensive wounds on his arms and hands, and he actually had his throat cut from behind.
Yikes.
Yeah, so he was murdered in prison.
I wonder if he, like, pissed the wrong person off, or...
He must have. Yeah. Or... Yeah, I don't know. It didn't really go into detail about what happened.
Yeah.
Nathan continued to, like, evolve their education system after Richard's death. He did suffer from, like, some serious depression following it. I did read in a few articles that it kind of came out later and through, like, more research that there is a possibility that Nathan and Richard could have been lovers as well.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting theory.
I just saw it in a few things. Like, the Smithsonian spoke very, like, openly about how they were lovers and just, like, different things. But, and maybe they're saying because he had the depression, or maybe because, I don't know.
Well, they probably also thought that because they were both supermen, like, that they were the only people that they knew who could truly understand them.
Each other, yeah.
Yeah, so they probably had a weird bond from that.
Exactly.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Sure.
Was Bobby assaulted at all when he was murdered?
No, but when they did the acid, it was on his genitalia as well.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
But there was no...
I almost wonder if it's like... I feel like a psychologist would take that part of it and be like, they were, you know, rallying against that because they were them attracted they to that, felt, or they were fighting that together. You know, they'd, like, come up with something.
Yeah. No, I could understand that.
Tough.
In the end, Nathan continued to be a model prisoner. He worked really hard to improve conditions in the jails and penitentiaries around him. He worked to reorganize the library. He revamped and taught all the prison schooling system, like I had mentioned. He even volunteered in the prison's hospital. And in 1944, he volunteered to be part of a malaria study that was being held in the prison. Basically, he was given malaria. Or pathogens of malaria, and he went through experimental treatments. He ended up writing a autobiography called The Life Plus 99 Years, which was published in 1958 in hopes that he would get parole with it. After 33 years in prison, Nathan was actually given parole in March of 1958.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. He basically, like, obviously couldn't do anything where he was. He ended up moving to Puerto Rico.
Huh.
Yeah. He was hired as a medical technician, and this Church of Brethren affiliated programs basically was like, oh, here, we'll take you to Puerto Rico. You can be a med tech and live your life there. And it seemed kind of like a rehabilitation situation, like, for him.
Actually.
Mm-hmm.
That word is brethren.
Do you know what that means?
Yeah, it's like a it's a word I feel like they use in church or like the Bible. Like it's when you're addressing a group of almost brothers. Like you would just be like, oh, the brethren.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, apparently they helped him.
That makes sense that those would be the type of people to be like, we'll take you in and give you a chance.
Oh, yeah, because he was given a home and a job. It basically, he was known by Nate, by his coworkers, his neighbors. He actually later married a woman. I don't know why I said that. So
No.
He later married a woman and earned a master's degree at the University of Puerto Rico. He became a researcher for their Department of Health, and he worked with the Natural History Society of Puerto Rico observing birds.
Tweet, tweet.
And published a book about it in 1963. On August 29th, 1971, at the age of 66, Nathan died of a diabetes-related heart attack. And that is the story of the not-so-perfect crime.
Yeah, very... very far from perfect crime.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Thank Tara.
Thanks, Tara.
I want to see what she wrote for this one.
Okay.
She had I screenshotted it because, you know, I just had so many comments. That's a joke.
I'm curious if Puerto Rico was a territory of the U.S. at that point or if it was its own country still.
I don't know.
Well, I know. That's why I'm saying I'm curious. I didn't ask you.
Oh, I thought you thought I knew.
Oh, no.
What if I didn't know that?
I think you would have said it.
I think they were still its own state.
Country.
Country. Yeah, this one was sounded confusing, but... huh. Emoji.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
this is a shrug one, for sure. Yeah. Man... rich kids with too much time on their hands.
And too smart.
And are too smart.
That's why I'm happy I'm not too smart.
Yeah.
Just the perfect amount of dumb.
Just the perfect amount. Just to, keep it fun.
Well, and to, that if I don't want to do something, I can just act dumb. And people believe it. Can you believe it?
No, I would never believe it. You're too smart.
I know. That's what people believe, but... that's that.
It's all part of the plan.
Yeah. Are you sure you don't want to tell us what you're going to tell us?
Yeah, I'm going to wait till next time because I think it's a couple of minutes a combo and we're almost at this point, we're checking in close to 2 hours.
What?
Yeah. So
we gotta go.
I think we should call it for today.
Oh my God. Goodbye. See ya.
Guys.
See ya.
Thanks for talking Murdy with us.
See you next week.